Have you ever walked into an empty room, maybe in an old house or some historic building, and you just like physically felt a presence?
Oh, yeah. Or, on a totally different note, have you ever been talking to your partner or a best friend and you just finish their sentence before they even open their mouth to speak?
Right. And not just guessing the general gist of what they're going to say, but the exact phrasing, like you just knew.
Exactly. And usually when we look at these kinds of deeply strange, almost unnerving human experiences, science basically tells us to step on a bathroom scale.
Yeah, it wants hard, binary, measurable facts. It wants to measure the weight.
Right. But I mean, how do you weigh a shadow?
You don't. You really can't use a bathroom scale for a shadow.
No, you can't. And you can't use traditional reductionist tools to measure the extreme edges of human connection and perception either. You need an entirely new architecture of measurement.
Which is exactly what we're looking at today, because historically we've had this massive explanatory gap.
Oh, absolutely massive.
On one side, you have orthodox science, which tends to just dismiss these events entirely. They just get written off as coincidence or confirmation bias or, vague intuition.
Yeah, or just people making things up. And then on the other side, you have parapsychology, which steps in and says, well, it's undefined magic.
Right, it's like quantum entanglement of souls or whatever buzzword is popular that year.
Exactly. And neither of those approaches actually gives us a testable mechanism. It leaves us in this sort of diagnostic no man's land.
Because dismissing an experience doesn't explain why the experience is so phenomenologically real to the person having it.
Right. And attributing it to magic doesn't give us a framework we can actually test in a laboratory.
Yeah.
So that gap between dismissive skepticism and untestable belief, that is where the truly fascinating science actually happens.
And bridging that gap is basically our entire mission for this deep dive. Today, we are opening up a really fascinating, incredibly dense stack of papers from the Brizard Research Archive, dated 2026.
Yes, specifically two groundbreaking frameworks by Jason Brizard.
Right, so we're looking at predictive convergence theory, which we'll call PCT, and residual identity echo theory, or RIET.
Right. We're taking two highly abstract, historically fringe phenomena, basically telepathy and ghosts, and seeing how these papers transform them from spooky campfire stories into rigorously measurable, testable scientific systems.
Which is just an incredibly ambitious goal. I mean, to take things that have lived exclusively in the realm of the paranormal for centuries and subject them to the most brutal, unforgiving scientific audits ever designed.
It really is. But Brizard isn't trying to prove that magic exists. He's trying to see if we can build a vocabulary to study the absolute extremes of human cognition.
So let's start with PCT, predictive convergence theory. This tackles the telepathy side of things, right?
Yes, exactly.
How do we move from people making untestable claims about mind reading at a party to a specific hard science solution for mind-to-mind connections? Because I was reading this paper and Brizard just throws the word telepathy right out the window in the very first paragraph.
Oh, he absolutely has to. I mean, the term telepathy just carries entirely too much metaphysical baggage.
Yeah, it implies this sort of mystical transmission of thoughts through the ether, right? Like a radio broadcast from one brain to another.
Exactly. And PCT completely abandons that framing. Instead, Brizard defines the phenomenon as an observed predictive convergence regime.
Okay, we got to unpack this. Observe predictive convergence regime. I mean, that sounds like an engineering term for a really specific type of machinery.
Well, in a way, it is. It's cognitive machinery. Brizard is grounding the whole phenomenon, not in transmission, but in prediction.
Right.
The brain is fundamentally a prediction engine.
So let me try an analogy here just to see if I'm tracking the basic concept.
Sure, go for it.
Think about the predictive text algorithm on your smartphone. When you first get a new phone, it gives you very generic suggestions,
These are
right?
standard dictionary words.
But after you've been texting on it for, say, 2 years, it knows your idiosyncrasies. It knows you say, sounds good, instead of okay. It starts predicting the exact sequence of words you're going to use next.
Exactly.
Now imagine two separate predictive text algorithms on two completely different phones that have been communicating with each other for years. Is PCT basically saying that those two algorithms might eventually start generating the exact same sentence at the exact same time without actually hacking into each other?
That is a phenomenal way to visualize it.
Yeah.
Yes, because they aren't hacking each other.
Yeah.
They have simply built highly accurate internal models of each other.
Oh, wow.
And PCT argues that this exact dynamic happens between two living, breathing human minds. It relies on a mechanism Brizard calls a recursive prediction loop.
A recursive prediction loop. Okay.
Right. So in any human interaction, one agent is constantly sampling the other person's output. You're taking in their words, their body language, the context of the room, their tone of voice.
Yeah.
All of it.
But I'm not just observing what they're doing, right? According to PCT, I'm using that observation to estimate something hidden. The paper calls it their latent state.
Yeah, the latent state. That's the unobservable reality inside their head.
Like their hidden intentions.
Exactly. Their intentions, their immediate memories, maybe the underlying emotion they're trying really hard to suppress. You can't see a latent state directly.
Right, because you aren't literally reading their mind.
Exactly. You can only make a bounded estimate of it based on the observable clues. So you sample their output, you estimate their latent state, and then you make a prediction about what they're going to do or say next.
And then reality happens. Like, they actually do or say something.
Precisely. And then you compare your internal prediction against their actual behavior. If you guessed they were going to ask for a glass of water, and they actually ask for a glass of water, your prediction is accurate.
Makes sense.
But if they suddenly start, you know, yelling about the electric bill, you have a massive gap between your forecast and reality. And that gap is what we call prediction error.
Prediction error. And if there's one thing I've learned about the human brain from reading cognitive science, it's that the brain absolutely despises prediction error.
Oh, it hates it. It is metabolically expensive and functionally dangerous to be wrong about your environment.
Right. The brain wants to be right so it doesn't get you killed.
Exactly. The brain is actively hostile to prediction error. It wants to minimize it at all costs. So prediction error acts as an update signal. If there's a mismatch, your internal model of that person has to be revised.
It says, okay, my model of my partner missed the fact that they're super stressed about finances today. I need to update the model.
Right. And through continuous, repeated interaction over days, months, or even years, that prediction error starts to contract. You're constantly refining the model.
And the paper uses a very specific mathematical term for this process. It describes it as a gradient descent interpretation applied to human interaction.
Yes.
Let's make sure that's clear for you listening, because gradient descent is usually a term you only hear when programmers are talking about training artificial intelligence.
It is a machine learning concept, yeah. Imagine you are standing at the top of a rugged mountain range, blindfolded, and your only goal is to find the lowest possible point in the valley below.
Okay. Blindfolded on a mountain. Sounds safe.
Right. You can't see the valley, so you take one step, you feel which way the ground slopes downward, and you take another step in that direction.
Because you're trying to go down.
Exactly. You keep taking incremental steps down the slope until the ground flattens out, meaning you've reached the bottom. In machine learning, the altitude is the error rate. You are trying to step down the slope of errors until you reach a zero error state.
So applied to humans, PCT is saying we do this with each other socially. Like every conversation, every argument, every shared silence is a step down that slope.
Yes. We are constantly stepping down the slope of misunderstanding. And eventually, a specific dyad, meaning two deeply connected people, might reach a valley where the error rate is functionally zero.
Wow. So they can almost perfectly anticipate the other person.
That is the convergence in predictive convergence theory. Your internal model of them and their actual internal state have converged.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. But here is the critical pivot in Brizard's work, right?
Yeah.
To make this an actual science and not just poetry about human connection, we have to measure it.
Right, we need hard data.
Because without measurement, how do we know we aren't just guessing really well?
Exactly.
If I guess my partner wants pizza on a Friday and I order it before they even ask, am I displaying an observed predictive convergence regime or do they just always want pizza on Fridays?
Right. I mean, everybody loves Friday pizza.
Exactly. So I need a way to prove that something structurally profound is happening, not just a lucky guess based on habit.
And Brizard anticipates that exact problem. This is where he defines three highly specific measurable variables that serve as proxies for convergence.
Okay, let's break these down.
The first one is latency. Or the variable L.
Latency is basically the time delay, right? Like the gap between observing a cue and making a successful response to it?
It is the temporal gap, yes. But PCT does not predict that as two people get closer, their reaction time just gets slightly faster.
Right.
That would be a mundane linear improvement. PCT predicts a nonlinear latency collapse.
I'm going to stop you there because that sounds like a fancy academic way of saying having really quick reflexes.
It does sound like that, yeah.
So how is a nonlinear collapse scientifically different from just getting faster with practice? If I practice catching a baseball, my latency improves. Is that a collapse?
It's a crucial distinction, actually. Let's look at the shape of the data. If you plot practice on a graph, the improvement is a gentle slope. You shave a few milliseconds off your reaction time every week.
Right, it's gradual.
A collapse is not a slope. It is a cliff. Brizard argues that when a true predictive convergence regime forms, the delay doesn't just slowly shrink. It plummets to near zero, or even into negative numbers.
Wait, negative numbers, meaning the response happens before the cue.
Exactly.
How is that even possible?
Because the system has undergone a phase shift. It's moved from being fundamentally reactive, where you wait for the person to generate a full signal, process that signal, and then act, to being fundamentally anticipatory.
So you aren't waiting for them to finish talking.
You are no longer reacting to what they said at all. You are acting on a perfect simulation of what they're about to say. The latency collapses because the need for the initial signal has been completely bypassed by the prediction engine.
That is wild. It's like your brain is just rendering their thoughts in advance.
Exactly.
Okay, so the temporal delay falls off a cliff. What is the second variable?
The second variable is bandwidth demand, or B. In any communication system, bandwidth is the amount of data needed to successfully transmit a message.
Right, like an internet connection.
Yeah. So when you meet a stranger, you have to use high bandwidth communication. You use full, grammatically correct sentences, explicit gestures, maybe even draw diagrams, because you have absolutely no shared context.
You literally have to spell everything out.
Right. But as your predictive model of that person becomes highly refined, the informational weight required to coordinate successfully just bottoms out. The bandwidth demand drops exponentially.
You don't need a paragraph anymore.
No, you need a single word. And then you don't even need a word. You just need a slight change in their breathing pattern. The predictive engine fills in the rest of the missing data automatically.
You know, I've actually seen this happen. You watch two really seasoned jazz musicians improvising on stage. One of them slightly shifts their posture or alters their grip on an instrument, and the other instantly changes the key of the entire song to match a solo that hasn't even started yet.
That is a perfect example.
The bandwidth they're using is almost zero, but the coordination is just flawless.
Exactly. And the third variable that enables both of those latency and bandwidth is representational overlap, or R.
Representational overlap. What does that actually look like?
This is the structural compatibility between the two minds.
So R is about how our mental filing cabinets are organized.
Yes. Perfect way to put it.
If we share the same cultural background, the same rigorous task training, or just years of living in the same house, we organize information similarly.
Exactly. So when I simulate your thought process, I don't have to translate it into a different format. My prediction of your filing cabinet is going to be incredibly fast because it looks just like mine.
I see.
Precisely. High representational overlap acts as the fuel for the latency collapse and the bandwidth drop. When all three of those variables align, you have the actual mechanics of PCT.
Okay, I follow the mechanics, but I got to push back hard here on the conclusion.
Let's hear it.
If we look at those variables, latency falling off a cliff, bandwidth dropping to zero, deep representational overlap, that just sounds like the definition of knowing someone really, really intimately.
It does.
So if a married couple can cook a complex Thanksgiving dinner together in a tiny kitchen, perfectly weaving around each other, handing off knives and spices without speaking a single word, is PCT saying they are telepathic? Does knowing your spouse make you psychic?
Well, Brizard is extremely strict about this, and the paper explicitly shuts down that assumption right away. This brings us to what he calls the boundary constraint.
Thank goodness, because if every couple married for more than 10 years is classified as anomalous, the word loses all meaning.
Completely.
So what is the boundary constraint?
The boundary constraint explicitly states that familiarity alone, no matter how profound, is not sufficient to qualify as a true anomaly.
Okay.
Every apparent success in communication, like your couple in the kitchen, must remain interpretable through bounded inference. It is not hidden transmission. It is not magic. It's observation, memory, and recursive revision.
So the husband knows to hand the wife the salt because she always salts the potatoes at this exact stage of the boil, and he heard the water bubbling.
Exactly. That is bounded inference.
So it's an incredibly impressive biological algorithm, but it's fundamentally mundane.
Yes. The boundary constraint protects the entire theory from just becoming a paranormal free-for-all. To move from a highly familiar couple cooking dinner to an actual anomalous predictive convergence regime, the diet has to survive a merciless auditing process.
Right.
You have to prove that what is happening is exceeding the bounds of normal inference.
Which brings us to what I think is the most intense, grueling part of the entire PCT paper. The 10 gates of falsification.
Oh, yeah.
Because having defined what this predictive engine is, Brizard now has to prove it isn't just a parlor trick or a lucky guess or people unconsciously reading micro expressions.
This is where the framework really separates itself from historical parapsychology. It doesn't want to prove telepathy. It uses a staged falsification ladder organized into three macro layers, and it's entirely designed to find every possible way to disprove the phenomenon first.
Reading through these gates, I was genuinely stressed out for anyone trying to pass them. It is designed to utterly destroy weak claims.
It really is.
Let's walk through this gauntlet for you. We start with macro layer I, ordinary explanation exclusion. This contains gates 1 through 4. I assume this is where we filter out the couple cooking Thanksgiving dinner.
Exactly. Before we even entertain the idea of an extraordinary predictive regime, we have to completely strip away the mundane.
Right.
Gate 1 tests for baseline exceedance. Are you actually performing better than random chance? Or better than a statistically matched control group of ordinary, highly familiar pairs? If you can't beat the control, you fail at gate 1.
Let's invent a hypothetical pair here to walk through the gates. We'll call them Subject A and Subject B.
Okay.
They claim they can anticipate each other's decisions in a high-speed sorting task without communicating. So they pass gate 1, right? They're statistically faster than average.
Yes.
Now they hit gate 2. Cue removal. What does this look like in a laboratory setting?
Gate 2 is about removing asymmetrical or privileged cues. Humans are incredibly adept at unconscious observation. If subject A thinks they are anticipating subject B's thoughts, but they're actually just unconsciously noticing that subject B dilates their pupils right before making a choice.
Oh, right.
That is cue exploitation, not an anomalous predictive convergence.
So how do you test that? You can't just tell them not to look at each other.
No, you systematically blind the environment. You put them in separate soundproof booths. You remove visual contact. You remove auditory contact. You even monitor the thermal signatures of the room.
Wow. Thermal signatures.
You remove any possibility that they are reading micro expressions or hearing microscopic changes in breathing. If you isolate them visually and orally, does the coordination collapse?
And if their telepathy suddenly vanishes the moment they can't see each other's faces, they fail gate 2. It was just body language.
Exactly.
Okay, let's say subject A and subject B pass gate 2. They're in separate soundproof rooms and they are still anticipating each other's choices.
Doing well so far.
Now they face gate 3, expectancy, shaping, and leakage. I found this one fascinating because it isn't even about the subjects, right? It's about their researchers.
It's a massive problem in any psychological study.
Yeah.
Gate 3 asks, are the experimenters accidentally helping you? The human desire for a positive result can deeply corrupt data.
Yeah, that makes sense.
If a researcher expects subject A to pick the red card, the researcher might unconsciously lean forward or hold their breath. Subject A picks up on that tension and guesses red. That's experimenter leakage.
Oh, this is the famous clever Hans effect. The horse that everyone thought could do math, but the horse was actually just reading the tiny involuntary facial tics of its trainer who already knew the right answer.
Precisely. Furthermore, gate 3 tests for the subject's own expectancy shaping.
What's that?
Well, if subject A expects to be highly aligned with subject B, subject A might unconsciously start altering their own random choices to match what they assume subject B will do, forcing a false pattern.
Just to please the experimenter or themselves.
Right. So the experimental design must completely double-blind the researchers and randomize the reward structures to eliminate this.
Which brings us to gate 4, rote-based exchange. Basically, if we completely isolate you from the researchers, from each other, from any known physical channel of communication, does the constrained residual pattern still exist?
Right. And macro layer I is really just clearing the throat. It is clearing out the noise of normal human interaction. If subject A and B pass gate 4, you've successfully proven that something interesting is happening that isn't just basic familiarity, body language, or a flawed experimental setup.
But you are not done. You don't get a medal yet.
Not even close.
Because now you enter macro layer 2, robustness and replication. This contains gates 5 and 6. Brizard asks, does the effect survive perturbation? What exactly does perturbation mean in this context? Because it sounds like you're just torturing the subjects at this point.
It kind of does, yeah. Perturbation basically means actively attacking the system to see where its breaking points are. If this is a genuine structural predictive convergence regime, it should have some architectural stability. It shouldn't be fragile. So the researchers add noise.
Literal noise, like static.
Literal noise, cognitive noise, temporal noise. You flash strobe lights to disrupt their baseline concentration.
Whoa.
You introduce a time delay between when subject A makes a choice and when subject B has to predict it. You introduce extreme cognitive load, like making them solve complex math problems while trying to maintain the predictive link.
You're literally stressing the predictive engine to see if the engine stalls.
Exactly. Because if the apparent telepathy only works in one perfectly quiet room on a Tuesday when both people are perfectly rested and sipping herbal tea, it's not a robust system. It's a fragile anomaly.
Right.
And if it survives all that stress, Gate 6 drops the hammer. Independent replication.
The graveyard of almost all fringe science.
Oh, it's the ultimate filter. Can an entirely different laboratory with different researchers who have zero vested interest in your success, using your exact locked analysis rules, get the exact same result with subject A and B?
Because if they can't.
If the anomaly only appears when a specific researcher is in the room, it's not a scientific phenomenon. It's an artifact of the room.
Okay, so subject A and B are legendary at this point. They survived the soundproof booths, they survived the math problems and strobe lights. Another university tested them and got the exact same result.
They must be telepathic now, right?
Not yet, because now they enter macro layer 3, generalization and audit integrity, gates 7 through 10. This is where the framework separates the highly rigorous from the merely anecdotal.
Let's focus on the heavy hitters here. Gate 9 demands adversarial reanalysis. This feels like a legal trial.
It practically is. You take your pristine replicated data set and you intentionally hand the raw data over to your harshest critics. You give it to the professional skeptics, the statisticians who basically build their careers on debunking paranormal claims.
Wow. Okay. And you ask them, find the mundane explanation we missed. If the skeptics can find a statistical flaw or a routing error in the experimental design, the claim fails.
The ultimate stress test of the data itself. But out of all 10 gates, gate 10 is the one that really caught my eye. Null preservation. I really want to spend some time on this because it highlights a massive flaw in how science is often communicated to the public.
Yeah, null preservation is really the bedrock of Brizard's entire philosophy. It addresses what academics call the file drawer problem. Science, as an institution, has a terrible systemic habit of hiding its failures.
Right. Let's explain how the file drawer problem practically works for you listening, especially in historically shady research like parapsychology. Let's say I'm a researcher in the 1970s trying to prove ESP. I run an experiment where a subject tries to guess the shape on a hidden card.
And they fail. They guess at random
Right,
chance.
they completely fail. So what do? I'm embarrassed, or I think the methodology was slightly off, so I take that data, shove it in my literal file drawer, and never publish it. I do this 19 times.
Just hiding the bad data.
Exactly. But on the 20th try, just by pure statistical luck, the subject gets 15 out of 20 cards right. It's a massive statistical anomaly. So I take that data, write a glowing paper, and publish it to the world.
And anyone reading that published paper thinks, my God, this person has ESP, because they cannot see the 19 failed attempts hidden in your drawer.
The published literature just becomes violently skewed toward false positive.
Because you only ever see the hits, never the misses. QCT demands that failures, breakdowns, and flatlines under stronger controls must be preserved in the archive.
Null preservation is built right into the gate itself.
Yes, if you hide your failures, if you cherry-pick your data runs, you fail gate 10. No matter how incredible your successes look, if your audit trail isn't perfectly transparent, the entire claim is invalidated.
That is such a vital safeguard. So this whole 10-gate gauntlet leads to the final output of the PCT framework, the ceiling rule. The rule states that the interpretive strength of your claim can never exceed the highest gate you've passed. Brizard breaks it into three tiers, right?
Right. The lowest tier is PCTI, bounded inferential convergence.
This is our married couple cooking Thanksgiving dinner. They pass the early gates. They have a remarkably strong predictive model of each other, but it's fundamentally ordinary inference based on observation.
Exactly. Then there's PCTC, constrained residual performance. You survive macro layer I. We put you in the soundproof booths and removed ordinary explanations, but the effect remained vulnerable to the heavier stress tests.
Like the strobe lights.
Yeah. When we added noise or time delays, the connection broke down. There is an anomaly, but it is highly constrained by the environment.
And finally, the absolute highest tier you can achieve, PCTR. Let me make sure I have the logic of this straight. If subject A and B go through all 10 gates, they survive the isolation, the strobe lights, the replication, the adversarial statisticians trying to destroy their data, and the file drawer audit. If they hit PCPR, the framework concedes that telepathy exists.
Right. No. And this is the most vital conceptual distinction in the entire paper. PCTR is not default proof of telepathy or magic or quantum soul connection. It's simply the strongest residual tier available within this specific framework.
Wait, I'm really struggling with that. They passed the most grueling scientific gauntlet imaginable. How is it not proof?
Because of what the framework is designed to measure. PCTR means the phenomenon survived absolutely everything we threw at it.
Okay.
It means there is a robust, highly anomalous predictive alignment happening between these two minds that cannot be explained by sensory cues, baseline familiarity, or statistical artifact. It means the behavior is real, but it does not magically prove a supernatural transmission mechanism.
I see. It proves that it is happening, but it refuses to invent a magical how.
Exactly. It says we have isolated an extraordinary human capacity that currently defies our baseline neurological models. It warrants massive, heavily funded further study. But it proves a behavioral reality, not a metaphysical one.
Right.
It defines the boundaries of the mind's ability to model another mind without demanding we rewrite the laws of physics just yet.
That is such an incredibly disciplined way to look at the unknown. It doesn't give you permission to declare magic is real, but it also doesn't allow arrogant skeptics to just wave it away as a parlor trick. It forces both sides to actually look at the hard data.
It creates a neutral territory for actual science to happen.
Okay, so we've spent a lot of time on PCT. We've seen how it takes the invisible wifey connection between two living, breathing minds and turns it into this measurable system of prediction and error. But what happens if you remove one of those minds?
Yeah, that's the big question.
Does the network just vanish? Or can a physical space and environment somehow record that signal? Because that question pivots us directly from the architecture of interpersonal connection to the architecture of memory and haunted spaces.
The transition here between Brizard's two papers is conceptually beautiful. We're moving from telepathy to apparitions, ghosts.
Yeah.
And we use the second framework, residual identity ecotheory, or Rylete.
This is where the material gets deeply, intimately unsettling. Brizard completely upends the traditional ghost story. If I read Riot correctly, it does not assume ghosts are trapped souls with unfinished business.
No, not at all.
It doesn't assume they're literal spirits pacing the hallways of a Victorian manor. Instead, it frames them, and I want to get the phrasing exactly right, as context-triggered reactivations of emotionally encoded identity states.
It's an academic mouthful, for sure, but the underlying psychological logic is profound. It moves the ghost from the supernatural ether into the neurobiology of the experiencer.
Wow.
Riot relies on a three-part mechanism. The first mechanism is effective imprinting.
Let's walk through effective imprinting step by step. Let's imagine a scenario. Someone experiences something intensely emotional in a specific room, a profound trauma, a moment of devastating grief, or even extreme life-altering joy. What is happening in their brain?
When a human being experiences high emotional intensity, the brain's recording mechanisms, specifically the interplay between the amygdala and the hippocampus, go into absolute overdrive.
They're capturing everything.
But the brain doesn't just record the sterile facts of the event. It doesn't just remember, I was standing in room 4B. It encodes what Brizard calls identity states.
And an identity state is vastly more complex than a standard memory, right?
Infinitely more complex. It records the exact posture of the person you were looking at. It records the specific microtonality of their voice.
So every little detail.
Exactly. It records the effect of presence, how heavy or light the air felt between you, the relational dynamic. It's an incredibly dense, holistic data package.
To use a tech analogy, it's the difference between taking a grainy 2D photograph of a room and taking a high-definition 3D spatial scan that records the lighting, the temperature, and the geometry of every single object.
That is exactly it. And those deeply encoded identity states are stored in the architecture of your mind. But they often remain dormant. They sit in the dark until they encounter the second part of the Riot loop, environmental resonance.
Environmental resonance. So the environment itself acts as the trigger mechanism. Let's say 10 years pass and you walk back into that exact hospital room or you walk into your childhood home.
Right. The human brain is constantly, unconsciously scanning its environment. It is always looking for patterns.
Always.
When you walk into that specific physical location, the room possesses sensory features that match the original encoding. It might be the specific smell of the floor wax. It might be the precise angle of the afternoon light cutting through the window blinds. It might be the acoustic dampening of the room, like the way sound dies in the corners.
And when enough of those environmental data points line up with the dormant 3D scan in your head,
it creates resonance. A threshold is crossed in the brain. The environment says to the brain, we have been here before under extreme circumstances. And that threshold crossing triggers the third and final step, identity reactivation.
This is where the predictive engine we talked about in PCT comes roaring back into play, isn't it? The brain starts doing what it does best, predicting.
Yes. The brain engages in predictive simulation. It senses the environmental cues, feels the immense resonance of that deeply encoded identity state waking up, and it automatically tries to complete the pattern.
It's connecting the dots.
It fills in the missing data. It simulates the presence of that identity, the person from the original memory, so vividly and with such high fidelity that it becomes a quasi-perceptual experience. The brain essentially renders the ghost in real time.
Reading this paper, the visual analogy Brissart uses to explain this really stuck with me. I want to lay it out here because it anchors this incredibly abstract concept into something you can almost hear. He uses the analogy of a bell.
It is the defining metaphor of the riot framework.
Let's map it out. Imagine an identity state, the deeply encoded memory, as a heavy brass bell. The intensely emotional event from your past, the trauma or the grief, is the hammer strike. The memory trace left behind in your neurobiology is the vibration of the metal long after the strike. The environment you walk into years later is the physical room that either amplifies or dampens that sound. And the apparition, the ghost you actually see standing in the corner, is the echo.
And that distinction is everything, mechanistically and philosophically. The ghost is not the original strike. It is not the event happening again, and it is certainly not a literal objective entity trapped in the house.
It's an echo.
It is a resonant reactivation. It is the echo. Riot explains how certain rooms, certain atmospheric contexts can make the biological bell in your memory ring again.
That honestly gives me chills. It reframes the entire concept of a haunting. It's profoundly human. It's not a haunting by the dead. It's a profound echo of human experience resonating in the present neurobiology of the living. But okay, we have the metaphor of the bell. Now I want to know how the brain actually rings it. Because if you talk to someone who has genuinely seen an apparition, they don't say, I had a really vivid emotional memory. They look you in the eye and say, there's a man standing by the door. We need to look at the cognitive systems that make the simulation feel so physically real to the observer.
Right. To explain that leap from memory to hallucination, Brissart introduces the specific neurological subsystems involved in rendering the echo. This is what the paper refers to as the alphabet soup of perception.
Okay, let's brave the alphabet soup. There are five main systems Brissart outlines. Instead of just listing them, let's ground this in a continuous narrative. Imagine a listener, let's call her Sarah, walking into her late grandmother's old kitchen. The house has been empty for years. Sarah walks in. The first system that boots up is PFT, the perceptual frame. What is PFT doing in Sarah's brain?
PFT is her brain's architectural scanner. It frames the current environment and actively amplifies the specific sensory cues that might trigger resonance.
So it's looking for familiar details.
As Sarah stands in the doorway, PFT highlights the faded yellow wallpaper, the specific quality of the silence in the room, maybe the afternoon light hitting the linoleum. It sets the sensory state.
It's gathering the resonant data. Then the second system activates, TFL. The TFL supplies the reactivated emotional memory. PFT says, this room is deeply familiar. And the TFL opens the vault. It pulls out the specific, intense emotional memory of her grandmother baking bread on a Sunday.
Now, the raw material is present, but it's unstructured. So the third system, SST, takes over. The SST shapes the identity simulation context.
How does it do that?
It takes that raw emotional memory from the TFL and synchronizes it with Sarah's current psychological state. It builds the avatar. It constructs the specific posture of the grandmother, the flower on her apron, the exact curvature of her smile.
But right now at the SST stage, it is still just a very vivid daydream inside Sarah's head. She knows it's a memory. This is where the crucial pivot happens, right? The fourth system, IRE.
IRE is the critical evaluator. It is the juncture between imagination and hallucination. The IRE evaluates the simulation and asks, is this echo internal? Is it just a memory I'm recalling?
Yeah.
Or is it an external reality happening right now?
Oh, wow.
It evaluates the simulation for threat levels and spatial location.
And if the emotional resonance is high enough,
if the resonance crosses the threshold, the IRE makes a profound error. It bypasses the cognitive tag that says this is just a memory. It assigns the simulation external reality. It takes the avatar built by the SST and projects it outward into the room.
So now Sarah sees her grandmother actually standing by the oven. But without the final system, it might just be a split-second flash, like a glitch in the Matrix. That's where TCRF comes in.
Yes. TCRF stabilizes the echo across time. It integrates the projected hallucination with the ongoing stream of reality. It ensures the figure doesn't just blink in and out statically.
Right.
Under TCRF, the apparition appears to move smoothly, perhaps walking across the kitchen or turning to look at Sarah. It gives the echo a coherent temporal narrative.
So PFT frames the room, TFL pulls the memory, SST builds the ghost, IRE projects it into the real world, and TCRF makes it move. It's a flawless rendering engine. But hold on, I have a major question here.
Let's test the logic. What's the gap?
If this entire process is just memory, simulation, and resonance happening inside Sarah's visual cortex, why do people claim to smell a ghost's perfume, or feel a drastic drop in temperature, or feel a physical hand on their shoulder? If there is zero physical stimulus in the room, no perfume bottle, no drafty window, how does a visual rendering become tactile or olfactory?
This is perhaps the most brilliant connection in Brizard's work. If we connect this back to the bigger picture of the brain as a predictive engine, we arrive at the concept of cross-modal reinforcement.
Cross-modal reinforcement, meaning across the different senses.
Exactly. Remember what I said about prediction error?
Yeah.
The brain hates incomplete data. It despises paradoxes.
Yeah.
Once the IRE decides this entity is external and physically present in the room, the brain has a problem. Real physical objects have mass. They have odor. They affect the temperature of the air around them.
Right. If a person is standing there, they should smell like a person.
So the brain, desperate to make its own simulation internally consistent, fills in the blanks. It pulls from the deeply encoded identity state.
I think I see where this is going.
If Sarah's original memory of her grandmother included the heavy scent of lavender soak, the brain will literally hallucinate the olfactory data to complete the predictive model. The brain manufactures the scent of lavender to justify the visual hallucination it just created.
I am going to pause on that because that is staggering. You are saying the human brain is so terrified of incomplete data, so desperate for its rendering of reality to make sense, that it will actively manufacture the physical smell of a soap that hasn't been in that room for decades. It hacks its own olfactory nerves just to cover its tracks.
It creates a perfectly sealed, multi-sensory loop, completely independent of actual external reality.
And this is why Rye is such an incredibly important framework, socially and psychologically. Think about the historical value of this approach. For centuries, if someone came forward and said, "I saw a ghost in my house and I smelled her perfume," society had two incredibly damaging responses.
Very damaging, yes.
They either called the person crazy and institutionalized them, or religious authorities stepped in and told them their house was haunted by demons.
Both responses are deeply alienating for the experiencer. They either attack the person's sanity or introduce literal metaphysical terror.
Exactly. But Riot does something revolutionary. It respects the phenomenology of the experiencer. It validates the visceral reality of what they went through. It looks at Sarah and says, "We believe you saw her. We believe you smelled the lavender. We believe it was a profound multisensory event."
Yes, but it provides a neurocognitive testable mechanism that entirely removes the supernatural element. It removes the stigma of craziness without erasing the truth of the experience.
It honors the emotional reality of the person while maintaining strict scientific materialism. It says your brain is capable of miraculous feats of rendering triggered by profound love or trauma.
Perfectly said.
So, bringing this all together into the grand synthesis, we've spent the last hour dissecting two incredibly dense papers. We have PCT, which maps the predictive connection between two living, highly aligned minds. And we have Riot, which maps the predictive connection between a single mind and the historical emotional resonance of its environment.
And while they deal with vastly different cultural tropes, the psychic and the ghost, they reveal a deeply unified theory about how human beings process the world.
So what does this all ultimately mean for us? What is the core takeaway from the Brizard archive?
The central thesis is that the human brain is fundamentally a predictive simulation engine. We do not passively receive reality through our eyes and ears like a camera recording a video. We actively, aggressively generate reality, constantly trying to minimize the error between what we expect to happen and what we observe.
It's all about the avoidance of error.
In PCT, we are furiously simulating the mind of our partner to reduce friction and error in communication, pushing the latency down to zero. In Riot, our environment forces us to simulate an emotional echo from the past because the context demands a resolution to an ancient, deeply encoded memory.
Wow.
Both phenomena are the brain doing the exact same job, predicting the world to survive it.
Brizard has taken these historically unstable, fringe topics that academics usually run away from, and he has built a rigorous vocabulary around them. Terms like latency collapse, prediction error, environmental resonance, cross-modal reinforcement.
Yeah, he really gave us a language.
He has created a shared language that allows psychology, artificial intelligence, and cognitive neuroscience to all sit at the same table and discuss the absolute extremes of human perception. It is a massive methodological triumph.
It truly is. He hasn't proven that magic is real.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, he's proven something much more interesting. He has proven that the mechanics of human cognition are far more powerful, far more strange, and far more beautiful than our baseline everyday models give them credit for. We are capable of rendering other people's thoughts and our own pasts with a fidelity that borders on the miraculous, all entirely within the bounds of biology.
To quickly recap our journey through the archive today, we started by learning how to measure the invisible bandwidth of human connection. We walked through the grueling 10-gate falsification ladder of PCT, learning how true anomalous alignment survives isolation, strobe lights, and the dreaded file drawer problem.
Right.
We explored how the temporal delay between two minds can collapse off a cliff. And then we walked into the haunted houses of our own memories with Riot, understanding how emotional imprints act like a struck bell, echoing as fully rendered multisensory apparitions when our physical environments provide the exact right resonance.
And I think there's a final lingering implication here that goes far beyond just debunking telepathy or ghosts. Looking at how powerful these predictive mechanisms are, it raises a deeply unsettling question for all of us.
Lay it on us.
We've spent this entire deep dive establishing that our brains are incredibly powerful rendering engines. We've shown they are capable of modeling other minds so perfectly that it looks like literal mind reading.
Yeah.
We've shown they can render memories so vividly, complete with manufactured smells and temperature drops, that they look like physical ghosts. We've established that the brain's primary overriding directive is to fill in the blanks to make the world make sense.
Right. The brain hates an empty space. It hates incomplete data.
So if our brains are this eager and this terrifyingly capable of generating entire multisensory realities from just a few contextual cues,
yeah,
how much of your everyday mundane reality is actually just a successful predictive simulation? And how much of it is actually there?
Oh, wow. Okay, so if I am capable of hallucinating the smell of lavender to justify a ghost, how much of my normal Tuesday morning commute am I hallucinating just because my brain expects the highway to look a certain way?
Exactly. We assume our baseline everyday perception is a clean bathroom scale, perfectly and objectively measuring external reality. But Brizard's work suggests that even the mundane everyday world might just be the shadow we are trying to weigh.
That is wild.
Most of the time, our brains are just rendering the echo of what we expect to see rather than what is actually in front of us.
The shadow and the scale, that is absolutely a thought to keep you up at night, questioning what you're actually looking at when you stare at the wall. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the Brizard archive. Keep questioning the boundaries of the known and maybe pay a little closer attention the next time you finish someone's sentence or feel a sudden chill in an empty room. Until next time.